Today I'm going to be interviewing Claudia Pond Ely for Cultural Icons. Claudia has been engaged so intensively, both with her art and with social issues, that her finding the time and energy to actually do all this is a miracle. She has also carried through the full role of marriage and raising children. She is one of our most consistently activist artists who has yet had the focus of vision to develop her own strongly marked style in the various media in which she works. If there ever has been an artist who shows us that art is a community process, it is she. Claudia, you come from a farming background. Would you like to say a few words about your early life and how that perhaps had some influence on your visual experience?
Well, yes, I was brought up in the Waikato, actually, in spite of my twangy accent, which meant that my mother was a war bride, a Canadian war bride, and met my father in Canada, so part of New Zealand history, really, as a young farmer went off to the war and trained in the Royal Air Force, and New Zealanders trained in Canada, and met my mother in Dorval, in Montreal. Yeah, that's out of Montreal. That's where he was located. And they got married during the war, and at the end of the war came back to New Zealand. My mother's just been telling me the story of the ship coming back through New Zealand to New Zealand with all the war brides on it. They weren't allowed to be in the same cabin as their husbands. They had to have their, or the women were together, or the wives, and often with babies in the small cabins. And it took some weeks, of course, to come to New Zealand. Well, my mother thought that she'd been terribly, terribly seasick all this while. And by the time she arrived in New Zealand, she was 89 pounds and had bought a grey suit with a black hat to arrive to meet her new in-laws, as it were. She said they must have thought this drowned rat sort of had arrived. Of course, she had been morning sick. She was expecting me by the time she arrived at the dock in Princes Street in New Zealand. So I was brought up in the Waikato, born and brought up in the Waikato in the Hinuera Valley. Awesome. And by the time I was 6 years old, my mother had had quite enough of living on a farm in a swamp. She had a lung disease, which meant that she wasn't well a lot of the time in the foggy marshes of the Waikato. And, of course, they've developed now. These lands have been drained and that. But in the 1940s, it was quite a different place. And so she went back to Montreal and took me with her back to her parents' house. And then my father and my sisters came out shortly afterwards. And so I was brought up by my family in Montreal. And my grandparents, as I said, still lived there. And my parents divorced when I was 10 years old. And my mother remarried a man who lived in New York City. So I was brought up actually from the age of 10 to 18, very formative years actually in New York. We were about 10 miles out of the city in the suburbs, a working class, blue collar, working class area. So it was quite an extraordinary upbringing. I went to Roosevelt High School. And my friends and neighbors were migrants that had moved up from the third generation, from early migrants, Lower East Side, the Bronx, and then where we lived in Yonkers, New York, near the raceway. And but I would get out of Yonkers every weekend and go down on the subway to New York City to the great museums. I used to go down to Washington Square on Sunday afternoons and to the place where they used to have, you know, it's in Greenwich Village, and listen to folk music. This was during the time of John Baez, Bob Dylan, and that. So it was an extraordinary upbringing, in fact. Seeing exhibitions at the Met, for instance, the Metropolitan Museum. I can remember walking into a room and the light, it was in the oval room, and the light was sort of playing on a Sunday afternoon. And it was actually Monet's Water Lilies there in the oval room. And I just was blown away. So I had extraordinary art and cultural experiences as a formative young woman. I can remember too being in Montreal visiting my grandmother. My cousin and I went to a Picasso retrospective exhibition. We almost didn't go in because we didn't think we had enough money for the tram to get home. But she explained to me that, no, we were students, so we could get in cheaper. So we went in. And that was like mind-blowing. There was the Des Moiselles d'Avignon and huge variety. It was one of the first times it had ever been exhibited. So there I am, 15 years old and walking into a gallery and just being exposed to all this stuff as such a young... And I really remember them as really significant events of my life. So when I was 18, I actually came back to New Zealand, but that was from New York City to Auckland, New Zealand. I went to the Elam School of Fine Arts then, and mainly because I was still a New Zealand citizen and this is the way I could get a tertiary education.
What caused you to take to art in this way? You obviously had an immediate and instinctive attraction.
Yes, I did.
Does that go right back to even before you left New Zealand, or was it something you discovered in America?
Oh, no, I think it's just part. Every child is an artist, I think, and I particularly love colour and, the magic of, fairy dust through the curtains, that shaft of sunlight. I can remember experiences like that as a, 4-year-old, this sort of thing. And I can remember when I was 10 years old, I loved colour so, so much. And I used to sit at my, in the dining table, because this is in Canada, and it's cold. You have lots of, many months of cold weather. You can't go and play outside unless you're ice skating or something. And, I would sit at the dining room table with a little oil painting set. I used to do, my mother encouraged me in sending me to Saturday morning classes at the Dixie Parks and Playgrounds. They had a children's art class, and I can remember winning a painting of a little dog I did in oils and winning a prize for that children's art and winning a set of oil paints. And I would actually paint for pleasure on the dining room table. Mm. My mother would put on the hi-fi, as it were, then the radio. It was sort of quite a rich sound, and it was... Every Saturday afternoon, it was the make-believe ballroom, and it was just classical music and things like that. And I realized now it was the Maple Leaf Ballroom because it was in Canada. And so those are
ballroom.
It was make-believe, and those are just magic moments for me. And I even then. And it's still, for me now, I think it's a part of a type of meditation when I actually paint. You just go into a zone where, you're in your own world of incredible depth and pleasure. And it has a lot to do with color and form and shape. Ideas. It has to have some idea behind it, a richness of idea.
What caused you to return to New Zealand?
Oh, it was a financial consideration. It was a huge one to make at 17 years old. I had three choices, and one was to go to Montreal and study art there. But I didn't have the French, because Quebec is a French-speaking. Mm. There was the English side of it, but I thought that would be difficult because I hadn't had the training in the French like my peer group would have done living in Canada and Quebec. And I wanted to go to New Paltz State University, which was an art education university in New York State, and but I just didn't have the money. I was in a situation, my mother had six children, it was very tight, I had to get out and make my own way in the world. So the other said, well, there's nothing for it, but maybe I'll come to New Zealand. I appealed to my father, and of course, being a New Zealander, I had a studentship for my fees, and it was a great way to get my education. Although it was quite a contrast from New York City to New Zealand, but it was at a time Colin McCann was teaching at the art school, and so I got a tough education, but it was demanding, and I think it was an excellent education for the toughness you needed to be an artist.
How did you find McCann as a teacher?
Very influential, very motivating, I was all ears and very attentive to his teaching. He was quite charismatic, actually, and As it turned out, my first day at university, I was at O'Rourke Hall, and my roommate brought home her psych lab partner she just met, come and have a cup of coffee sort of thing. So she came around and she said, "Oh, Claudia, I've heard, the only other time I've heard the name is on my family tree." And I'd just come from New York City, so that didn't mean anything to me. And then the next week she came, she said, "Oh, you're on my family tree. We're cousins." And it was Colin McCann's daughter. And that was through her mother, actually, Anne McCann. We were descended from a grandmother and a grandfather. Great-grandmother, great-grandfather came to New Zealand at the same time in the 1800s. And we both descended from this brother and sister. So she became a very close friend, and we went flatting together. So I had a lot to do with the McCann family. I used to go around there because we flatted. I used to go around there for dinner on Sunday nights, Sunday roasts sort of thing. And because I was a long way from home and from my parents in Matamata to my father in Matamata, it was very nourishing. It was a really interesting environment. It was a whole new world for me of these art lovers. And extraordinary people would be there for dinner as well. So I got to mix and match, not only with the young people, she had four, there were four children, so I was a peer group with them, but also with the older people that were there as well.
And arriving in Auckland, a different kind of a landscape and different light from Canada and New York. Mm-hmm. Can you remember your feelings about that?
Oh, getting off the boat in September, getting off the ship, literally, and driving in the car through the landscape. The grass was emerald green. I couldn't believe the color. It was so rich. I've always had a response to color. And I just thought it was amazing. And of course, I mean, you know, and then as it, you know, Pohutukawa trees and things as it became summer in New Zealand and that. Yeah, I found it quite magical. And also living in Matamata, I mean, it's by the kaimais, and the view from my parents' house was of the kaimais, and that was the whole environment. So I did a lot of drawing and that on the farm, and, you know, cabbage trees and the landscape and this sort of thing, coincidentally. I had 6 months living in Matamata and orientating to New Zealand life, interesting culture. This is Yank, you know. I still had the really twangy accent and the money, of course, was pounds. And I worked in a shop, so my father got a little cash box for me. Played shop so I'd be okay in to actually work in town. But he was really, really keen to get us all driving because we were 8 miles out on a farm, get us driving so we got driver's license. My sister came out as well at the same time and getting a job in town, like Monday morning, go find yourself a job sort of thing. And I did.
So this is 1964, is it?
Yeah.
You are back in the Waikato.
Yes. But that was quite interesting too. There was a retired school teacher that also worked in this bookshop. So working in a bookshop was good because I got to know a lot, learn a lot about New Zealand culture. But also as Una Platt's book, Wash Day at the Pa, came out at that time, Spinster, Ashton Warner's books were in the shop. So, and I was really interested. I was sort of led to these books and read them, and so I got to see that there was more intellectual life here in New Zealand than just cows and the farm.
Yes, I was going to ask you, how did you see yourself in relation to this sort of emergent sense of a New Zealand culture at the time that you were at Elam?
Well, I think when I was at Elam itself, I was more embedded in, you know, art student culture. So all the other students there were other weirdos as well. Everybody sort of came together, all this mix of different people from all sorts of different situations and places. So university is good like that. And because you're 18 years old, everybody's come from wherever they've come from and merged together.
And you did 3 years at Elam, did you?
Yeah,
and
about 4 years.
When you had finished, how did you see where your future might lie? Were you able to begin working as an artist in anything like a full-time way, or?
Yeah, McCann had actually been very challenging to people sorting out the sheep from the goats and, you know, who here is really going to... He was very provocative. Who here actually is going to become an artist? I bet most of you know, you're going to become teachers or something like that. And I had actually gone to art school really originally to get the training to become an art teacher, and that's how you did it, to get a ticket. But he was really encouraging about us to see ourselves as professional artists. And, it never really occurred to me before that, but I was able to have a balance between the two. I did go to training college.
Did you teach?
I teach at the university. I've taught for 37 years. This is my 37th year at the School of Architecture at Auckland University, teaching drawing. I've taught with Pat Hanley for about 25 years. Both of us worked together. And then he retired, and I got an assistant for myself as well to teach the job from then on. So that's been continuous life drawing and freehand drawing for architectural students.
So you didn't have to go into the school system and face those 40 pupils in a class?
Yes, I did. I did go to training college. Oh, dear, yes. Yes, and I did. I went back and did a master's degree about 15 years ago, and I was offered a part-time job at a girls' school, private girls' school, and that helped pay off my degree. Yeah, and I made a bit of extra money, but that was just for 1 year, and that was just part-time. But I still always continue. I've tried to work around that, and I try and teach night school and community in community situations, and to do workshops, teach workshops and this sort of thing outside of the secondary school system.
And at that time, as you're emerging from art school, were you already focused on the kind of subject matter that I see, let's say, in your garden paintings? In other words, were you already strongly focused on painting natural imagery?
Yes. My first paintings when I left art school were actually of the Parnell Rose Gardens, because we lived in Parnell in Judges Bay, and a big colour field work was done by that huge big canvases, and then I would use color field based on the imagery that I'd seen in the rose gardens, sometimes with the sky and then the color, color spectrum, really. So they were color field work during that time, very abstract, but based on that love of color yet again.
Yes.
Yeah, and when we moved to Mount Eden, we bought our own house on the wrong side of the tracks of Dominion Road down there in the slums. Of course, the whole area now, we went and planted trees all over the place. It's really lovely now, but at the time it was the wrong side of the tracks. And I think it's because I came to New Zealand with such... was really open to the subtropical here, and I just love that, and I love the... luscious growth that we have here in Auckland. So our garden had nothing in it. It was a clothesline and an asphalt everywhere. There was one pureri tree and some bamboo. And so we started planting things in the garden, thanks to friends, different cuttings and things like that. And so I started painting that eventually when we moved there. So I was really grounding myself in my own environment that I had planted myself. And, of course, the banana trees come from that time as well. They became quite an iconic image of that, of the tropical Mount Eden, you know, in the background. So there's a whole series of paintings based on that over a long period of time.
Yes, I see your work as being particularly focused on that Auckland subtropical Pacific light environment. Or perhaps more than almost any other painter that has been living here in recent years.
I think it's because of the colour too, because the oranges, you know, an orange, citrus, I fancy having citrus growing in your garden. You can pick it off a tree and eat it. and lemons. And so you get the orange against the blue sky, for instance, this clear, clear, beautiful blue sky we get on occasion here in Auckland. And so you get that complementary colours, the two colours vibrating against each other, which give a lot of energy to the work. With the banana plants, you get often a red, certainly get the seed pod, which is bright red, and which hangs over with all the seeds in it, but against these beautiful green leaves. And that, again, is complementary colour. So I'm really interested in that and getting the vibration working, and a lot of energy in the work due to that.
Now, at the time you were training at Elam and in subsequent years, I was on the edges of that group of people myself, and I often heard that we were going through a phase where painting nature as such wasn't very trendy, despite the fact that people like McCann were teaching at Elam and their work was so focused on a natural metaphor in a way. Did you ever have any problems in dealing with, should we say, critical prejudice about your natural inclinations in subject matter? This is at the height of New Zealand modernism, I suppose. Was there an attempt to force you into a more urbanised form of imagery, anything like that?
Well, I know that it was important to... the women's movement had started around that time as well. And I really went through a crisis. It's a painting away, as you do. And then, well, what do I have to say, really, as I'm a woman painter? What do I have to say? And I realized that Pat Hanley, of course, was working, you know, in that sort of his way as well. And while that was amazing and beautiful, I really had to look at myself and say, well, I have a unique perspective. I'm a mother to start with. There was hardly any artists before that who'd been mothers that had actually continued to paint, which I actually did. This is, let's see, in the 70s. My daughter's was born in 1970 and another daughter in 74. So I'd had the experience of being an artist at the same time. I mean, I was painting with a baby sitting on my knee often in my studio. And that's where I think the colour field work came in. It was very nice to sort of paint away like that. 20 minutes, that's what you'd get at a time, and you have to go and do something for the baby and then do some more like this. And but that's how it had to be. So you had sort of a broken focus, but I still continued to paint all that sort of time, having baby-proofed the environment so that the baby didn't get hurt from the paint, etc. So I'd always actually been painting during that time. But I realised that my experience, by the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, that my experience actually, in the way I saw the world, was actually quite different from how the masters, as it were, you know, the McCanns and the Hanleys and this sort of thing. So I then started really grounding myself in my own experience. Mm. And so that's why a lot of the paintings of my garden, the way I planted it, the children were often young children are in my paintings during that time. So the particular location of my work brings in my family situation as well.
Were you aware, again, in that fairly early time, of New Zealand artists like Frances Hodgkins, Rita Anglis, Olivia Spencer Bower, Doris Lusk, who had managed to stay on track as painters and as women, particularly, of course, going back to Frances Hodgkins, she managed to stay incredibly much on track as a woman artist for a very difficult period.
They didn't have children.
Did none of them have children?
None of them had children. Doris Lusk might have, but I did know Doris Lusk.
Yeah.
Rita Angus didn't have any children.
No, she
and
didn't.
So it makes it... I realised I was in a unique situation.
Yeah.
And I think this has been helpful, too, to other women artists, that actually it can be done. I think for me, McCann threw his hands in the air when I said I was expecting a baby. I said, "Oh, well, that'll be the end of you. What a pity," you know. And I said, "No, if I'm a painter, no matter what happens, you know, if I have a baby, that's fine. It's no problem." And see, I was in New York. That my mother had six children, so I was a teenager, always had a baby on my hip. So, you know, I had to help out. That's just how it was. It was a necessity. So actually having a child, well, I was fully attentive to my child, my children. I still knew that that wasn't the be-all and end-all, that, you know, I had to still keep my own creativity going as well. So I did. Mm. And so that was an interesting thing, wasn't it, when I think about it?
Well, yeah. It is.
Yeah.
Going so back they didn't... to your North American heritage, were you acquainted with the work of Georgia O'Keeffe when you were living in
New York? I don't know if I was at that time.
Did she have children?
No.
She didn't?
No, they didn't have children. I certainly knew about Rita Angus because we studied her. She was one of the trinity, as it were, with Tom Marie as our art teacher in the school. Fine arts, our art history lecturer. And so that was Wollaston, McCann, and Rita Angus. So they did bring a woman in there. But I wasn't particularly drawn to her work. I mean, I acknowledge it. I acknowledge the three of their works.
And at what point did the issues of feminism gradually emerge for you as artistic subject matter? Had this begun as you left Elam and began working as an artist, or did it happen later?
Not for a while. Until I was sort of working in my studio. Where was I going? What was I doing? What did I have to say? And of course, there was a lot of theory, and it was, you know, the Judy Chicago works were becoming publicized, and there was more and more theory and exposure about women artists speaking from their own perspective. And that was very exciting for me because it opened up a whole new possibility. There was I was part of a group called FAN, Feminist Art Networkers, which consisted of about six or seven really poignant women makers and shakers, feminists, trying to make some influence in the art world. It's quite interesting to see who were members at that time. And we went for quite a number of years and would make submissions and do political stuff like that. We would meet regularly.
FAN was Auckland-based, wasn't it?
Yes, Feminist Art Networkers they were. Mm.
Who were some of the other people in it?
Cheryl Southern, et al., Marilyn Tweedy, Juliet Batten, Carol Shepherd, and Liz Eastman. She lectured in art history, and myself, and there's probably one more, Juliet Batten.
Yeah, so many of them are still active, aren't they?
They are, yes. They have Alexa Johnston as well. Mm. So they'll have very prominent positions within the art world. So that was a very powerful, working with them. Yeah. Mm. I also belonged to VANA, Visual Artists Against Nuclear Arms, which was about our nuclear work, and that's, of course, in the 80s as well.
Yes. And Persephone, would you like to enlarge on her?
Yes. The Persephone series is about being a mother, but I did a painting in 1984 when my daughter Bridget became a young woman, as it were, Menarch Shield for Bridget. So I realized this is really exciting material, that who else had done paintings about their daughter's menarche when they became their first menstruation. Your child that you've brought up is now becoming a woman. And I didn't know any paintings like that. So I, of course, had been working on Shield paintings, and I was also a member, I could say, of the collective of the Women's Gallery in Wellington as well. So that was another influence, and was participating in exhibitions there. So this painting, man, it was scary, but I did this painting, and it was about Bridget using the shield motif in her schoolgirl outfit, Auckland Girls Grammar School, as it were, in front of a gate, leaving. you know, out into the world. And there were images there in the work of her drawings that she'd done as a young girl called Pretty Ladies. Girls about 8 or 9 do these drawings of what pretty, you know, perfect beauty queens type of thing, Betty Queens, they used to call them. And so children's drawings and paintings, archive, primitive goddess images, Stonehenge, just so many different images that were had a meaning for a woman's universal part of the universal cycle, as it were, the moon, menstrual cycles, these sort of things. So anyway, I exhibited this, scary. I didn't do it in my dealer gallery, which was Rodney Kirk Smith's gallery, RKS gallery. At the time, to start with, I exhibited at it was a women's association, women artists. I was also a member of that. So it was a heck of a lot of activity and excitement around the women's movement at that time. And I showed it at that one of those exhibitions there. We had an annual show. And that was okay. A lot of support from women artists. And I've read things since that people have written in their diaries and that. I think it was quite a strong work to have at the time. And then eventually it got, oh, this is so scary putting this out, this tricky subject matter and that. Well, 10 years later, it was, you know, in the books on, it was published in books and that. And now it's on the curriculum for writing essays about for secondary school. So it
Why were you so nervous of that as subject matter? Did you think it would attract some kind of puritanical censure or...
It was sort of like taboo material that. You'd never talked about, you know, menstrual cycles and let alone being related to the moon and tides, things like this. I think you're crazy. But it was such an important and such a deep, deep spiritual cyclic thing that I wanted to put it in. I did do, I had also had text, which was, different spiritual aspects of the moon and the qualities thereof, blood, stone, working on earth. Yeah, so it was like the elements, but it was looking at the lunar elements.
So you were perhaps responding to the fact that New Zealand was still predominantly a Protestant country and that these were, might still be vaguely heathenish ideas or
I just think
too
it was,
animist or...
I think it was because it was such a personal taboo subject that, and to actually paint it and broadcast it on a painting on a wall... It was a huge thing to do.
In the matter of Persephone... Well, she seems to be engaged in all of this somehow.
Yes, because these are the daughters.
Is she perhaps symbol for you of women who must emerge, often with great conscious effort, into the public world and then pull back to a kind of, in a sense, I don't mean this negatively, they pull back to their underworld of domestic life and then they come out again and they...
No. The Persephone series is about sex, drugs and rock and roll.
Right.
It's about teenagers, adolescents. Persephone gets abducted into the underworld, which she needs to do to draw away from the mother who's Demeter. So she had the mother figure, the Persephone figure. She goes into the underworld, as it were, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, if you like, and has to explore an area like that in order to become her own individual self. And then the mother grieves. And there is a lot of grieving, as you see, you know, the strong bond you have. You know, and then they're out in the world. You still, you know, what do you do? Make a safety net for them. But Demeter grieves for the loss of her daughter. And then, of course, an agreement is made. The daughter comes back to her, but as her own person, in fact. And it's a seasonal thing, isn't it? That becomes spring. And Demeter, of course, in her grief, has set winter upon the land. And when she has the opportunity to come together with the daughter again, it becomes spring and there's a celebration, but with the acknowledgement that the daughter will disappear and return to her own self, as it were. Mm.
So you're taking an archetype and you're putting it in late 20th century context.
Right.
But I feel sometimes when I've seen your Persephone at the bottom of the painting and she's sleeping, that represents also a sleeping feminine sort of earth anima coming into the sometimes painful light of mental consciousness as she has to come out and then she goes back into this phase. Is that going on in those works, you think, as well?
I think there's a lot of... they were actually exhibited at the Napier Gallery, a whole setting of that, of those works. And, it's about a depth, a mystical sort of depth, a spiritual depth, and, sort of a realm beyond. And then you have this coming back. There's an interesting grieving thing. I was listening to something on the radio yesterday about parents... holding on to the kids. Well, you can't do that because how are they going to become adults? How are they going to fend for themselves in the world? But it's a huge, huge tug for a woman. And again, this is subject matter that who had ever painted about this before? So I was painting my experience as a mother.
Right. During this general period in which you were engaged in painting the process of the feminine in a way. You also began to be aware or to engage in the issue of peace and of protesting against the military-industrial complex, the nuclear-industrial complex. Can you remember what first brought that to mind?
Well, as a family, we've always been socially conscious, and I was aware of the resuming of nuclear testing at Mororoa. That was in the 60s, wasn't it, and coming through the 70s, and then they resumed again in 1995. But I went to Kiribati. My friend Robin White, we would meet each other every year, either in Dunedin or in Auckland or something, and hang out in each other's studios for a week every year, as it turned out. And she moved up to Kiribati, which is right on the equator, in the doldrums, as it were. And she lived in a grass hut beside the lagoon. And she would come back to New Zealand every year or so when we get together. And she said, "Oh, you should come up and see me." So I said, "Oh, yeah, that'd be cool. I'll do that." So I went to the travel agent to see how much, and it cost a fortune. I think it was $700 or something. I said, "Oh," and so I said, "All right, I can do that." And then when I actually went to book the ticket, and I said, "I'd like my daughter to come as well." That was Bridget, my eldest daughter, and she was 13 at the time. And when I went to the travel agents, that was one way. And it turned out, I said, "Oh, I don't know if I can do this." But I sort of told everybody I was going. So I sort of had to go. But I'm so glad I did. I actually spent the money on the airfares. It was crazy. You had to go via Vanua to Solomon Islands, Vanua to Nauru. I had to sit in Nauru for a couple of days waiting for the plane to come. And if it weren't for Air Nauru, never would have got to the Kiribati anyway. And wound up on this place on the equator, directly above New Zealand, actually. And she and Michael were working with the Baha'i community there. So I spent a month there, and my daughter came as well. And it was an extraordinary experience. And that's where I really started doing some interviews. And I can remember speaking to somebody there when I was there about nuclear testing in the Pacific. This is 1984. And they sort of poo-pooed, "Oh, that doesn't bother us." That was about, Mororoa. "Doesn't bother us, here we are up here." But I became very aware that the pollution in Marshall Islands, for instance, where they had done Bravo and during the 50s, was just a hop, skip, and a jump over the horizon. So I was very aware of that. So that was really when it hit home. I was eating fish. We were eating fish out of the sea that could have swum over there.
Were the Kiribati people
Sickly? No, not particularly. They're sickly anyway because, I mean, yeah, everybody has upset stomach. Yeah, it's a difficult place to live. It's an atoll. There's nothing much to eat there except fish, imported rice, and coconuts.
Right.
And if it weren't for coconuts, they wouldn't be able to survive there. And they're atolls. There's no soil, so you can't grow anything. They do have a lot of vitamin deficiencies in the population. Yeah, so it's because of the Marshall Islands, and I was aware of the nuclear testing there during the 50s.
Would it be fair to say that Kiribati was your first-hand introduction both to the Pacific as a physical environment and as a political issue?
Yes, I had travelled through the Pacific coming to New Zealand on the Oriana, and I'd also flown up through the Pacific when I went with my mother, and you had to island hop in an aeroplane to fly to North America at that time. So I have very strong memories of being in Fiji. I think we stayed in Canton Island, tiny little island there, Hawaii, and then the west coast of the United States. So we're living in a little hut in by the lagoon, but it was stunningly beautiful. But even that is all polluted there. They don't have sanitation, and you know, they filled in the causeways, which mean that the lagoon doesn't get filtered and that. I kept a diary all the time I was there, and so did Robin when she first went there too.
Is this the outcome of the diary?
Yes, yeah, combined diaries and my experience of being there and combining our artwork, because we would go off drawing because we're both artists, so we'd spend the day go off drawing. And when she came back to New Zealand just a few months or so later, I said, you should see all the work I've done based on our trip and the sketches and the drawing I've done. She said, you should see all the works I've done. And so it was quite an interesting, so very significant work came out of being there in 1984, just at that New Year's period for both of us. Hmm. Which went on, I must say, another publication I did, 1995, was a publication about Mororoa. So I did banners for the different boats that went off to Mororoa. David McTaggart, one of the founders of Greenpeace International, said, come on, all you Kiwis, come on out to protest, resume testing at nuclear testing at Mororoa. And I got a telephone call saying, oh, would you like to do some banners? Well, a whole bunch of people were supposed to gather and do. I thought, oh, yeah, it's time to, I'll help out. So I turned up and nobody else came. Oh, Nora West came the first day and then she got called off to some other thing. So we made a banner for a big press conference and we painted it on my kitchen table. And she said, oh, I guess we better get this down to the place where the flotilla's sort of meeting for the press conference. And but half an hour later, I said, oh, I better. So she took it off down to the place, pinned it on the wall, as it turned out. And so I turned on the TV, the news, and voila, there was this banner that we'd just done, like, you know, half an hour before, 40 minutes before, on the wall in front of all the sailors and that were about to go, and skippers that were about to go off to Mororoa in the next couple of days. That's very powerful. This is the time to act. This is what I can say as an artist. I can, you know, get out there and make banners anyway. So very practical person I am. I had a studio, got the materials, and a whole bunch of people were supposed to come and help, but of course, wound up being me. Odd people came on odd days, and so I made 14. There are 14 yachts, 14 banners. I think I did 3 banners for each boat, for each side of the. So I was very interested in what they looked like when they actually left. So I was there to wave them off and went to the rally.
Was that flotilla that left just after the Warrior got bombed?
No. This is years later. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. This is 1995.
Right.
Yeah. So I waved them off, and they all had. So I had met all the skippers, you see, and so I said, oh, I'm still quite interested in this. So I recorded the news every night, and I sort of built up the memorabilia and the news cuttings and the sort of thing that was based on the, because they were gone for months, in fact, and kept an eye on what was going on. So when they returned, I was really interested, because the Rainbow Warrior did get taken, as it were. It went into the zone and did get taken then. And we've seen pictures of that ever since. When they came back, I was interested to see what the images looked like because the communication was broken by the boat being taken, Rainbow Warrior 2, that would have been. And so it went and audio interviewed all the skippers and that. So in here, there actually is 45 interviews and a resume of what happened in history.
I presume then that you're completely comfortable with the idea that art must be engaged or should be engaged in social issues. You're not one who's ever been tempted by the idea of art for art's sake.
Art for art's sake as well. Yes. I'm a Gemini. I think I've got both aspects of lots of aspects of things. And also I've been doing it for 40 years, so I've had plenty of time, you know, in different situations. We do have a family that's engaged in political ideas and activity and discussion and that. So it's stimulating. I mean, for instance, when the different nuclear ships coming into New Zealand, the Peace Squadron, I mean, a lot of the discussion was around my kitchen table, in fact. People would drop by and talk about it. So when the different issues come through in our New Zealand social history, in the last 20, 30, Springbok tour, that was 30 years ago, it's interesting that the issues are discussed around my kitchen table. And so I think they influence your work.
And your garden, would that be subject matter that might be near to more art for art's sake?
And the play of colour and, the aesthetics of that, yeah.
But even the garden is a subject that's in the world, isn't it? It's not just a theory. It's the vitality of nature, and the way you've titled some of those works, it suggests that it's in almost a religious enclosure, and that the plants are spirit forms. What do you think of what's the title you used in regard to one of the garden paintings? I've forgotten it now, but...
Spirit Gardens.
Yeah, Spirit Gardens.
Okay, now those are based on being actually at Lotus Gardens and Water Lily Gardens in travelling to Asia. Yeah.
Right.
So that's actually from sitting and drawing in a situation where people do make meditation gardens, yeah. That was from 1990. Yeah, so that's quite a contrast, isn't it, between the highly political and then getting a place that is a spiritual, a place, yeah, of meditation and spirit, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And they balance one another out.
Right.
Would you regard your own garden in that light as a spirit garden?
I guess you could say that, yeah. But in particular, the lotus, the water lily, are images from Eastern philosophy and... yoga practices and that, yeah. So I'm very interested in that as well. So they're huge, of course. I have a tendency. I've been doing bonsais lately, of all things, just drawing them from a friend's garden. He does bonsai. And I thought, oh, bonsai, yeah, you're very nice. But boy, you sit down and you try and draw them. There's such a perfection in the balance of the way things are cut and, in their shapes and that. And but the irony is I make them big. You know, bonsai is supposed to be these little things, but I make them big. So it gives it a flourish. And same thing with the spirit gardens. They're huge paintings, yeah. So you get really immersed into that space.
And I suppose also that even when painting... let's say a gardened interior, you're still in a way in an art political world as well, because you're affirming ecological realities as well as spiritual ones, aren't you? And that is in a way a political statement as well.
Yes, I think so. And a celebration of health and balance and lushness.
And another area in which you go into what I might call symbolic interior is with the shield works and with the perspex, the works on perspex, where you assemble an array of symbolic figures. Would you like to talk a little bit about your journey to Crete and to Turkey and to going back quite deliberately to find some of those archetypes in Western history?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was just a wonderful opportunity and a luxury, really. I'm always aware of the monetary cost of travel like this, and I don't think I could afford to go and have the grand tour around Europe and the expense of that. So tended, if I have a break, is to Asia, where it has a draw for me. But this particular opportunity was working on a yacht, a friend's yacht, and he invited us to become crew, my husband and I. It was just a small little boat, just the three of us. He was traveling around there on his own yacht for health and recreation, for his own health, actually. It was a health cure. And so we said, oh, wow, well, at least we don't have to pay for hotel bills and we'll just buy food locally and that. So I became the chief dish and bottle washer and cook and shopper. And we went around, we went to Turkey first, as you're right. I went to Turkey and then met up in Greece, Mykonos, actually, and traveled around. And then I said, well, tomorrow I'm going to be in the archaeological museum, so you boys will have to make your own lunch, sort of thing. And I would just go with my drawing. I've always drawn, loved drawing. So I would just go with my drawing pad. And it was so exciting for me because I really felt that this was like a hub of my own ancestral background. So I have used images of Sumerian goddesses and the different goddess figures you see in these places, just on vases, and so I just drew and drew and drew and drew and drew. It was great. Yes.
Are you acquainted with Jung's writings? Are you affected by them?
I've read those, and I think so. That's right, archetypes, and very interested in archetypes. I think that I use that a lot in my material. I still am, actually. My material and the paintings I'm doing at the moment are just based on those, finding and selecting universal images. They can come from architecture, from human figures, from archaeological, might be flower images, or anything like to come into the universe, universal forms, come together in a matrix and a way of seeing the world that we're all made of and composed of. So it comes a little bit out of Eastern philosophy as well, about matter and particles and what is form.
Yes, I found in the notes that you gave me a splendid word that I can't resist using, spanda.
Uh-huh.
That was the word that
spanda,
we were discussing.
I love it, yes. Spanda. Yes.
Now, how did you come upon that concept?
Okay, that's about universal energy. That's about the vibration of the universe. I think it's wonderful. That's what happens when people really go into themselves and meditate, and when you just go deeply, into the gardens, into the spirit gardens, into your own garden, having that experience. Yeah, it's a spiritual experience, really, which we all do have. And I think for me, really, that's what painting and drawing is about, is going into that other space. And it's just vibrating on this sort of level, which is so, so deep and so enriching. If we can just get rid of all the clutter and the chatter and that, there is this vibrational energy of the whole universe, which is really, it's mother, it's about the energy of the universe.
And how did you come across that concept? It's a Sanskrit concept,
yes,
isn't
it? Yes,
it
is. Through yoga and through my interest in Eastern philosophy, Vedanta, studying it, reading about it, going to India, spending a lot of time here in New Zealand as well with yoga groups and that sort of thing. It's all here. I mean, you don't have to go to India to do it, but It's very wonderful to go to India and to spend months working and living in an environment like that, which you can do. But it's very, very special.
Mm. So you've gathered in many cases, as is the case with the painting behind us, or the sheet, it's a Perspex work, isn't it?
Yes.
You've made a field of images, and I'm interested in how you feel the interconnection between them, or how you create that interconnection between them. I suppose it's a form of collage, isn't it, in a way?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
How did you proceed towards that? How did you get that balance that's in it? Can that be even put into words?
Well, you mean a balance of the different elements, the universal elements?
Of the elements, both in a formal sense and in their symbolic sense, in the sense of the meanings that connect them.
That's right. Just by searching, finding images, and then collecting, they're always unique in the Shield series. Each of the shields are unique, so each of the different chevrons, there's not another one that looks exactly like how this is, that the images will come together like this, talking about this particular work and through here. Well, they come from many, many different periods. They come from old encyclopedias. They come from finding them of my own, you know, childhood books, from alchemy, from historical, prehistoric images, for instance. Tree of Life, it's a drawing that I did in particular in there. The goddess, the Sumerian goddess, you know, as you're talking about Cretan images, the days of the week, and actually all those gods in the boat, as it were, and through here. And some of the images come from architectural drawing manuals, how to draw, a lot of things. I collect old vintage books and see if there's images in there, and particularly black and white, you know, line drawings are of interest to me. So some of them come from my own drawings, and some of them come from found images, historical images. And that's just done by perception, really, is bringing them together as an artist, as I say, in a unique way, each of these. These are done through silkscreen printing, actually, putting them. I have lots of images on screens, so they're photographic silk screens. It's actually printed images, and then I hand paint them. Like these paintings on Perspex, they're screened, and then I paint in reverse on the back of the Perspex and build up the colour. And also, again, that colour play is really important to me as well.
I've noticed in these and in a lot of your actual painting that everything is often on a blue field.
Mm.
And I have wondered whether the work of Matisse has had an effect on you. Relative lack of perspective, everything is in an eternity of blue, as it were, rather than having the dynamic time concept that's often implied in where perspective is strong in painting. Work like this is virtually without perspective, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Everything is existing at once.
Yes, yes.
Is that something that you picked up on early in your training, or by looking at some modernist European art, or just
probably a combination? Yeah, instinct. Yeah. All those things, I would say. I'm certainly attracted to Matisse's work. Mm. Again, this blue sky thing, this vastness, the universal, I think that has a lot to do with it. It just gives this infinity, infinite space, which is attractive. And I love blue. I love the colour. It's my favourite colour as well. So all the things you're saying is true. Because a lot of things you do are quite instinctive, while you pick things up and why you reject other things, because there's infinite choices in the world, but you do things because you are yourself, and that would be the same for every person who's an artist, every child that draws. You're making decisions all the time and expressing your own individuality. Quite interesting working on the Perspex. I've been working on Perspex for the last 10 years, because I was doing some, I had a commission, two commissions actually, to do stained glass windows, big, massive ones, 11 windows for St. Mary's Cathedral Church in Parnell, for instance, and using beautiful hand-blown glass from Lyon in France. And when I completed the commission, it was my millennium one, particularly the one in Parnell, going back to work on canvas, everything went a little bit flat. And I thought, oh, working with this beautiful glass, I thought, oh, I can't work on glass, but I thought, oh, Perspex might be another way of doing it. So I have seen one Asian, just recently an Asian artist had been working on Perspex as well, but it's all quite a unique process to work like this. I don't know of any other artist that works like that.
And glass and as and the Perspex also often is dealing with images that are placed without perspective or a sense of time. They're in this timeless infinity, aren't they?
Mm.
They're floating in the glass.
Mm, yes, yeah.
And I've noticed that you've transferred some of the techniques you use in bounding the forms in your painting. They fit very well with working in the medium of stained glass too, because that's filled with those black lines and boundaries. And yet they also float in this sort of timeless milieu. Now, to pass from that to film, how did you go from these worlds of you know, the ground, the blue ground of infinity, how did you go to something as very contemporary as film? What caused you to move in that direction?
Well, I thought I was writing a book. I'm on the Greenpeace Voting Assembly, and I was mixing and hearing all these amazing stories by other people who were on the voting assembly, who often were former crew members in that of Greenpeace. And I heard stories of the Rainbow Warrior, and they were stories I had never read before, even though I, you know, looked at lots of read books and knew the stories in that. But they were from the women crew members of the Rainbow Warrior, who had been on the Rainbow Warrior. So I decided to, because this is after the time I'd been working with the flotilla, and so I had written that book. And I thought I was writing a book, actually, so I went and interviewed these women who had been crew members, and they were great stories. So I got a Peace and Disarmament Educational Trust grant to interview probably about 10 or 12 women activists that had been involved with Greenpeace and with boats mainly, ships, and activities like that. And so I sent it out to all the publishers. But I thought, while I was doing this, maybe I asked a friend, Annie Golson, let's say I want to make a feature film, I mean a documentary film, something suitable for the festival, for a festival or something, what would I need? She said, just a 3-chip camera. And so I said, oh, okay, how much do they cost? About $7,000. Well, I didn't have $7,000, so that was that. I forgot about it. Then at the school, the place where I work at the university, I was borrowing a light lead, an extension cord for one of the classes I was running there. And I said, have we got a 3-chip camera here at all? And because I'd seen some students with some cameras and that. And he said, yeah, here's one. And he picked it off the shelf and he said, yeah, borrow it for the weekend to see how you go. Bring it back on Monday. So I played around with it. And I wound up just recording the women that I was interviewing. I would set up the camera. It was just me and them. So there was no distractions, whatever. I would sit on one side of the camera and ask them the questions, do the interviews, and then I'd go on the other side of the camera just to change the angles a little bit. And so beyond my wildest dreams, this actually became a pilot film. And I had a young volunteer from Greenpeace. They have a room where they do some editing and that. And there was a young volunteer I didn't know much about filmmaking or anything, and I thought a young person knows a little bit more about videos and how you cut and splice them and stuff. And he said, oh, listen to the stories they're telling. And he had just been sorting out all the videos that they had on the wall into a bookshelf making, and they've been sitting in a box for years and years and years. And he said, oh, they're actually doing the things they're talking about, these people on the films. So we had a look. It was a lot of old archival material from Greenpeace that were just sitting on the shelf in boxes for years. And so we did a bit of splicing, putting them together like that, and made for $4,000 with a young editor called Briar March. We actually put together a little pilot film. Took the film and applied to Creative New Zealand, and I got a grant to make my first film, literally. It was thanks to Briar, really. I had helped her out in a legal situation she was in and supported her. Talented young filmmaker, just graduated from fine arts school. Yeah, she's gone on to make fabulous films too, but this is, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. And anyway, it's an income for her, and so we worked on this film together. And then we got the grant, and so, and I must say, too, a friend donated $4,000 that I needed to make the little pilot film. I showed her the rough footage we had. She cried, got out a checkbook, and wrote out a check for $4,000. And so we were, that was to pay for the editing and get it together. And so I got a grant from Creative New Zealand Screen Innovations, and I was so pleased with that. So I went back and re-interviewed everybody and really got together my first film, which was called Departure and Return, The Final Journey of the Rainbow Warrior. And it was stories about the Rainbow Warrior that people just didn't know about. It wasn't a spy, you know, the spy versus peace activist film. It was that was just a small part of it, because I think the whole story was really lost when it was bombed, and they had a much bigger message to tell the world. And it was, of course, about nuclear testing and the results of that. That's the last part of the film, anyway. But it's like talking about Marshall Islands and the nuclear testing there that people became victims of, but also gave the history of the Rainbow Warrior and how it started. A whole bunch of people had a dream and answered an ad in the paper because they advertised for a boat. They wanted a ship to go and help save the whales, as it were. And I thought it was that's one of the good messages, I think, and it was inspirational, should be inspirational to young people. If you've got a dream, it is possible.
And you can do things with film, I suppose, that are much harder to do by painting or doing works like these, in the sense that you can narrate things in film in a way that is harder to do in painting or in visual.
Drawing. I found about... I'm working on my fourth film now, but I went on to, the thing that I found so captivating about it was that it was so multi-layered. You have the content, the narrative, but you have the setup and the way it's composed. So that's like being in a painting as well, making a painting. You have the color coordination, you have the lighting, which is really, really important. And then you have the voice, you have the archival referencing you can use in it, you have the music, you have archival footage, as I say, and there's so many different layering and elements on it. I found it was like making a huge epic painting that had so many layers and content to it, and I found that really, really exciting, and it kept my mind busy because I walk down the beach, I think, oh, I could do this and I could do that. Yeah, you can bring that in here. And different things sort of come into your life that seem to come together appropriately in the right time and right place that make a final composition. And all the films I've made have wound up being in, film festivals and documentary festivals and television. Yes, Māori television, the documentary channel.
Now, you spoke to me of film opening a new door as if it gave you a newfound freedom as a medium.
It did. Well, one thing, it was non-toxic. I was finding after a while that my paints were very toxic. The acrylic paint even has formaldehyde in it, and I was getting very sick. Especially the inks and stuff like that. So it gave me a break from working 8 hours a day with a very toxic media as well. Nobody ever talks about that much, but it's a lot of artists have got very sick from years and years, day in, day out, working with materials. So, I mean, after all the chemicals they get on your hands, they go on your skin.
Heavy metals.
Yeah, they do.
Heavy metals and pigments.
That's right. Mm. And the formaldehyde, which stops it from going moldy, so I guess it's a necessity. Yeah, think about all the stuff, snap dryers and that in the inks.
So when you make a film, would it be fair to say that sometimes you may still be thinking as you would making a collage-like work like this, but you can fit a lot more into it, so to speak, or you have more plasticity with time in a film?
And you probably have a lot more engagement of the audience in what you're having to say if they're in a darkened room with the work of art, as it were. Most of my films are about 45 minutes or 60 minutes, 64 minutes was the first one. In fact, I had so much content in the first film about the Rainbow Warrior because I want to talk about the Peace Squadron, I want to talk about New Zealand being nuclear free and all this sort of thing. Well, you couldn't get all that into one film. So I then made another film which was drawn from that. And I can tell you, these films are made for $8,000, $15,000, no income whatever, but they've just been a passion. And it's not unlike being an artist. You just do it because you've got to do it and you want to do it, that you can't think of any monetary return, whatever. And I've been grateful for the support that I've got and people, helping out to make it happen.
Would you like to talk briefly about your long acquaintance and collaboration with Pat Hanley?
Oh, well, he's been a family friend, Gil Hanley as well. They've close family friends. Pat Hanley sadly died about 5 years ago of Huntington's disease, Huntington chorea. I worked with him right from, 1974, just working with him. He lived around the corner from us, Gil, and he lived around the corner. So he's often dropping in. My husband, Peter, works from home as well, so it's a family affair. And then I would spend 2 days a week. At that time, we were teaching like all day for all first-year students and all second-year students at the University at School of Architecture. So we would spend, we'd do a repeat lecture 2 or 3 hours in the morning. And so it was 2 days a week. So there's quite a lot of time to get to know somebody's ideas and philosophy of life and things.
Because he had a similar range of commitments, didn't he, the anti-nuclear thing and the Peace Squadron and everything.
No, we have an exhibition that's going around the country at the moment. It's mainly focused on a children's book that was written about Pat's protest paintings, about anti-nuclear paintings, and Gil Hanley's photographs of nuclear activity and protests, and my film No Nukes Is Good Nukes, plus Departure and Return shows as well in that film. That film in the exhibition that's been traveling country for 2 years is called Blast. It was supposed to be in Christchurch at the Art Gallery opening about now, in May, April, May. But of course, they've cancelled it because of the earthquake. But it's touring the country.
Right.
That was at the Auckland. It was curated by Lopdale House in Titirangi. And so it opened there. And Gil has released Pat's paintings that are in the family collection to be in that show.
And your most constant contact with him was through another thing with which you've had constant contact. Perhaps it's the thread that runs through your life in a way, and that is drawing, isn't it? You always taught drawing with him, and you've always done drawing. Do you think drawing has been for you the line of the visual, the development line of the visual throughout your life as an artist?
Yeah, you could say that. Yeah. just an enormous pleasure that comes from doing that.
And you're still doing it intensively.
I am indeed. Yes, I just bought myself a new rotary pen the other day. Mm. more ink. And whenever I travel or I go somewhere, I always have a sketch pad with me and I just draw for the pleasure of it, no matter where I am, whether it be on holiday in New Zealand or roundabout or whatever. Mm. And often landscape and visual things that do with the environment.